Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to ICERM Radio, a global peace network dedicated to promoting inter-ethnic and inter-religious cooperation.
Featuring programs that inform, educate, engage, mediate, and heal.
Broadcasting from New York City, the cultural melting pot of the world.
Join us in listening to news, lectures, dialogue, documentary interviews, book reviews, and music.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
My name is Ria Yoshida.
And I am Beth Fisher Yoshida. And today we'd like to talk with you about the field of intercultural conflicts. And we'll use the experiences we have had either personally in our own work and living around the world, or in the workplace in our work with clients. And this can be on a couple of different levels. One could be on the individual level with clients where we work with them in a coaching scenario. Another can be on an organizational level in which we work with teams that are very diverse or multicultural. And a third area can be when we work in communities when you have different groups of people who assign different meanings to being a member of that community. So as we know, the world is getting smaller. There's more and more communication. There's more mobility. People are able to interface with difference or others on a more regular basis, much more frequently than ever before. And some of that is wonderful and rich and exciting, and it brings about so much diversity, opportunities, creativity, joint problem solving, multiple perspectives, and so on. And on the flip side of that, it also is an opportunity for a lot of conflict to arise because maybe somebody's perspective is not the same as yours and you disagree with it and you take issue with it. Or maybe somebody's style of living is not the same as yours, and again, you take issue with it, and maybe you have different sets of values and so on. So we'd like to explore with a couple of more realistic examples of what really has happened, and then take a step back and use some of the tools and frameworks that we tend to use in our work and our lives to explore some of those situations more thoroughly. So maybe we can start off with Ria giving an example of you growing up both in the U.S. and Japan, and maybe something that happened to you that was an example of an intercultural conflict.
Sure. I remember when I was 11 and I first moved to the U.S. from Japan, it was in Sunday school. We were going around the classroom introducing ourselves. And it came to be my turn, and I said, "Hi, my name is Ria, and I'm not very smart." It was an autopilot 11-year-old response in an introduction, and now reflecting back on it, I realized that the values in Japan are to have humility and a sense of humbleness, which is what I was trying to go after. But instead, the response I got from my classmates was one of pity. "Aw, she doesn't think she's smart." And there was a moment where I felt suspended in time and internalize, oh, I am no longer in the same environment. There aren't the same value system or implications of it. And I had to reevaluate my situation and notice that there was a cultural difference.
Very good example there. So it's interesting. I'm wondering then, when you did experience that, you did not get the response that you had anticipated. You did not get the response that you would have gotten in Japan. And in Japan, it would have been probably one of praise. "Oh, look how humble she is. What a wonderful child." Instead, you got pity. And then what did you think about that in terms of how you felt and the responses from the other students?
So there was a moment where I felt a separation from myself and other. And I desperately wanted to connect with my fellow classmates, that there was beyond the value, the cultural values of Japanese or American, but there was this human need to want to connect to other people. And yet, there was this internal dialogue that was happening for me, one of conflict, where I felt these people don't understand me, as well as what did I just do wrong?
Interesting. So you said quite a few things that I'd like to unpack a little bit as we go forward. So one is that you felt a separation, and a separation from yourself, as well as a separation from other people. And as humans, we are, as some people have said, social animals, social beings, that we have a need, one of the identified needs that different people have identified as a series of needs, universal and general and specific, that we have to connect, to belong, to be with others, and that means to be recognized, to be acknowledged, to be valued, to say the right thing. And it's an interactive response where we say or do something, want to elicit a certain response from others that make us feel good about ourselves, about our relationships, about the world we're in, and then that in turn elicits a subsequent response from us. But you weren't getting that. Sometimes people, any of us, in situations such as that, may be very quick to judge and to blame. And that blame can come in different forms. One could be blaming the other. What's wrong with them? Don't they know they're supposed to respond a certain way? Don't they know they're supposed to recognize me and say, oh, wow, how humble she is? Don't they know that's what's supposed to happen? And then, well, wait a minute, maybe there's something wrong with me. So then we sometimes turn that blame internally and we say, we're not good enough, we're not correct, we don't know what's going on. It lowers our self-esteem, and then there are different kinds of reactions from that. And of course, in many situations, we have blame going both ways. We have blaming the other and blaming ourselves, not creating a very pleasant scenario in that situation.
Yes. There's a level of conflict that happens on multiple levels, the internal as well as external, and they're not mutually exclusive. Conflict has a way of entering a scenario and an experience in many different ways.
True. And so when we say the word conflict, sometimes people have reactions to that because of our own level of discomfort in managing conflict. And I would say that how many people like conflict, and basically nobody would raise their hand if I ever asked that question. And I think there are a couple of reasons why. One is that we don't know how to manage conflict as an everyday tool. We have conflicts, everybody has conflicts, and then we don't know how to manage them, which means they don't turn out well, which means we're destroying or damaging our relationships, and so naturally we want to have a couple of techniques of avoiding them, suppressing them, and just staying away from them completely. Or we could also think of a reframe of the conflict situation, say, you know, something's going on here, it doesn't feel good, and I'm going to figure out a way to feel better about this situation and take the surfacing of these conflicts as an opportunity to create good conflict or constructive conflict. So this is where I think we have an opportunity for differentiation of constructive conflict, meaning constructive process of addressing the conflict, leading to a constructive outcome, or a destructive process of how we manage the conflict situation, leading to a destructive outcome. And so maybe we can explore that a little bit, too, after we go through maybe a couple of more examples of situations. So you gave an example of a personal situation. I'm going to give an example of an organizational situation. So in a lot of the work that Rhea and I do, we work with multicultural teams inside of multinational, multicultural organizations. Sometimes it gets even more exacerbated when there's other levels of complexity added in, such as face-to-face versus virtual teams. Because as we know, in the field of communication, there's so much that happens non-verbally, facial expressions, gestures, and so on, that gets lost when you're virtual and then really gets a whole new twist on it when it's only in writing and you don't even have the added dimensions of tone of voice in there. of course, I didn't even mention all of the language complications that happen as well. Even if you're speaking the same, in quote, language, you may use different words to express yourselves, and that has a whole other way of going now. So we want to think about an organization. We think about a multicultural team. And now you have, let's just say, 6 members on the team. You have 6 members who come from very different cultures, cultural orientations, which means they bring with them a whole other set of what does it mean to be in an organization, what does it mean to work, what does it mean to be on a team, and what do I expect from others on the teams as well. And so very often in our experience, teams do not sit down at the beginning of coming together and say, you know what, let's explore how we're going to work together. How are we going to manage our communication? How are we going to manage if we have disagreements? What are we going to do? And how are we going to make decisions? All in there. So because this is not explicitly stated and because these guidelines are not reviewed, there are many opportunities for conflict situations. We have a couple of different dimensions that we've used, and there's a wonderful reference, the SAGE Encyclopedia of Intercultural Competence, and Rhea and I were fortunate enough to be invited to make a couple of submissions to that. And in one of our articles, we looked over a couple of different dimensions that we gathered from a variety of sources, and they came up with about 12 of them. I'm not going to go over all of them, but there are a couple that might be relevant to examining some of these situations. For example, uncertainty avoidance. There are some cultural orientations which are more comfortable with ambiguity than others. In the coordinated management of meaning called CMM, there's a concept of one of the principles of mystery. And all of us have different levels, individually and culturally, about how much ambiguity or how much mystery we're comfortable dealing with. And after that, we sort of go over the edge, and it's no more. I can't deal with this anymore. So for some people who have very low uncertainty avoidance, then they may want to have a very carefully crafted plan and an agenda and a schedule and have everything really defined up ahead before the meeting. For other people of high uncertainty avoidance, you know, let's just go with the flow. We know we have to deal with certain topics. We'll just see what emerges in that situation. Well, can you imagine you're sitting in a room and there's somebody who really wants a very tight agenda and somebody else who actually resists a tight agenda and wants to be more in the flow and be more emergent? What happens there if they don't have that kind of conversation about how we're going to set agendas? How are we going to make decisions and so on?
Yes, I think these are really great points that we are multifaceted individually and collectively. And it's sometimes a paradox that the opposite can exist and coincide. And what this does is, as you mentioned, it has an opportunity for more creativity, more diversity, and it also creates more opportunities for there to be some conflict, and to look at that as an opportunity for change, as an opportunity for expansion. One of the things I'd love to highlight is when we're managing levels of intolerance within ourselves and levels of anxiety, and that often we are quick to react, quick to respond, because the anxiety we experience is intolerable. And especially if we don't have a lot of language around these topics, they can happen within seconds between people. And there's a level of surface conversation and there's meta conversation. There's constantly communication happening between people, non-verbally, in the meta world. And we won't get too into the philosophies of it because we want to address more of the tools and how to manage these situations.
Great. So I'm also thinking that if we want to really complicate things a little bit, what if we add in the whole dimension of power distance? Who has the right to decide what we do? Do we have an agenda or do we go with the emergence and flow of what happens in the moment? And depending on what cultural orientation you have towards power distance, you may think that, okay, if it's a high power distance, it really does not matter what I think or care about because I have to defer to the higher authority in the room. If you are from a low power distance orientation, then it's like we're all in this together and we all have the opportunity to make decisions together. And then again, when you have that clash, when you have the person who is of higher authority and power thinking he or she is going to be making those decisions, but then gets challenged, or what they perceive as a challenge, by somebody else that they did not anticipate getting somebody else to express their opinion about things, then we have other situations. I also wanted to bring in a third context of where these intercultural conflicts can occur, and that is in communities. And one of the things that's happening in the world, and it doesn't mean it's happening in every part of the world, but in general, and I know from my own experience of growing up in the same neighborhood for many years until I went to college, compared to now when you have an increased level of mobility for a variety of reasons. It could be because we have refugee situations, we have mobility within a culture, and so on. There's more and more incidents of different types of people from different backgrounds, different ethnic groups, different orientations, living inside of the same community. And so it could be something as subtle as different cooking odors that can really incite neighbors to really get into conflict situations because they don't like and they're not accustomed to and they judge the cooking odors coming from a neighbor's apartment. Or we can have a neighborhood where there is public shared space, such as a park or a community center or just the streets themselves. And people have different orientations to what does it mean to share that space and who has the right to that space and how do we take care of that space and whose responsibility is it? I remember, now I grew up in New York City, and you took care of your own apartment and you had somebody taking care of the building and the streets and so on, or basically the streets were just sort of nobody's territory really. And then when I lived in Japan, it was so interesting to me how people would come together, I think it was once a month or twice a month, to volunteer to go and clean the local neighborhood park. And I remember being very struck by that because I thought, wow, first of all, how do they get people to do that? And everybody does that, but then I think, like, do I have to do that also? Am I part of this community, or can I use the excuse of not being from this culture? And I think on some occasions I did clean, and some occasions I used my cultural difference not to do that. So, excuse me, there are lots of different ways of looking at the context. There are different frames of how we can understand if we have the mindset that it is our responsibility to take a step back and understand.
Mm-hmm. So based on your knowledge of different intercultural factors, such as values and other dimensions, why do you think it happened that way? How did Japanese people come together in a group, and how come the cultural differences in America or your experience in New York City manifested the way it has?
So a couple of reasons, and I think that it doesn't just happen that all of a sudden this is a norm. It's part of our educational system. It's part of what you learn in school about what does it mean to be a good contributing member of society. It also is what you're taught in your family, what the values are. It's what you're taught in your neighborhood, and it's not only what you're intentionally taught, but it's also what you observe. So if you observe somebody opening up a candy wrapper and throwing it on the floor, or you observe that candy wrapper ending up in a wastebasket, or if there's no wastebasket around, you observe somebody putting that wrapper in his or her pocket to be thrown away in a wastebasket later on, then you're learning. You're learning about what the societal norms are of what should and should not be. You're learning the moral code, the behavioral and ethical codes of that situation. So it happens from when you're very young. It's just part of your fabric, I think, of who you are. And so in Japan, for example, more collectivist-oriented society, there's more of a belief that the shared space is communal space, and so on. So then I think people do come forward. Now, I'm not saying that it's an idealistic world, because there are also shared spaces that nobody claims and that I've seen a lot of garbage on, such as when we used to go hiking to the mountainside. And I remember finding in myself a big contradiction of what is taking place, because I thought, why is it that in this space nobody is claiming that this is their space and they clean up the garbage, whereas in other spaces, people think everybody plays a role. So it is something I noticed, and because of that, when I returned to the U.S., when I returned to the U.S. to live, and when I returned to the U.S. to visit, I became more aware of those kinds of behaviors. I became more aware of shared space that I wasn't beforehand. Mm-hmm. I was aware of it.
It's really interesting. So there is a huge systemic base to a lot of the things that we experience on a day-to-day basis. Now, for a lot of our listeners, this can be a bit overwhelming. What are some tools that we can address right now to help our listeners understand in a conflict situation that they might face in their workspace, in their personal lives, or in their community?
So a couple of things. Thank you for asking that question. So one idea is to think about what I mentioned earlier, CMM, Coordinated Management of Meaning. One of the basic principles here is that we create our world. We create our social world. So if we've done something to create an unpleasant situation, that means we also have the ability to turn that situation around and make it a good situation. So there's a sense of agency that we have. Of course, there are circumstances as other people and the context we're in, the community and so on, that influence how much agency or control we really have over making a difference. But we do have that. So I mentioned one of the three principles of mystery earlier, which is around the ambiguity and the uncertainty, which we can turn around and say, you know what, it's also something to approach with curiosity. We can say, wow, why is it that this happens the way it does? Or, interesting, I wonder why I expected this to happen, but instead that happened. That's the whole orientation of curiosity rather than judgment and feeling insecure and uncertain. A second principle is coherence. Each of us as humans try to understand. We try to make meaning of our situations. We want to know, is it safe? Is it not safe? We want to understand, what does this mean to me? How does this affect me? How does it affect my life? How does it affect the choices that I need to be making? We don't like dissonance. We don't like when we don't have coherence. So we're always striving to make sense of things in our situations, always striving to make sense of our interactions with others, which leads to the third principle of coordination. People, as we mentioned earlier, are social beings and like to be and need to be in relation with one another. Relationships are critical, and that means we have to dance to the same tune. We don't want to step on each other's toes. We want to be in coordination, in sync with others, so that we create shared meaning together. And that when I communicate something to somebody different from me, I want them to understand what I've said in the way I want to be understood. When we don't have coordination, maybe there's too much mystery in the relationship, then we don't have coherence. So all three of these principles interact with one another.
Yes. That's great. What I'm picking up a lot about this is how we can have enough self-awareness to feel congruent within ourselves. That we can also experience dissonance within our individual selves between how we feel, what we think, and what we hope the outcome will be. So when we're interacting in relationship with other people, whether it's one other person or in a team, or in a group organization, the more people, the more complex it becomes.
Correct.
Yes. So how can we manage our internal dialogue in a meaningful way to bring congruence within ourselves in hopes to have our intentions match the impact we have on our interactions?
So if we think about ourselves as a phrase that some people have used as instruments of change, then that means every situation we go into, we are that opportunity for change, and we are that instrument, so to speak, that being that has a direct influence on everything around us, which means we can influence for better or for worse, and it's up to us to make a decision. And it is a choice, because we do have those critical moments when we can make choices. We don't always, or we're not always aware that we have a choice. We think, well, I had no other choice. I had to do what I did. But in actuality, the more increased our self-awareness is, the more we understand ourselves, the more we understand our values and what's really important to us, and then we align our communication and behavior with that knowledge and awareness, then the more agency and control we have about how we influence other situations.
Great. And I remember, Beth, you were talking about in CMM how to create space and the tempo and timing and how important this is.
Yes. So, you know, I often do say timing is everything because there's an element of readiness or rightness that has to happen for you, the context, the other party as well, about how and when you're going to engage. When we are in a very heated emotional state, we're probably not our best selves. So it's probably a good time to take a step back and not engage with the other because nothing constructive is going to come out of it. Now, some people do buy into venting and that there needs to be a venting, and I'm not against that. I think that there are different ways of dealing with our emotional expressiveness and the level of emotionality that we have and what is constructive for that particular situation with that particular person about that particular issue. And then there's the tempo. Now, I do come from New York City, and in New York City, we have a very, very, very quick pace. And if there's a three-second pause in a conversation and it's my turn, I can jump right in there. When we have a very quick tempo, and again, quick is judgmental, what does quick mean? When we have a tempo that feels quick for the person in the situation, we're also not giving ourselves or the other party time or space to manage their own emotions, to really think clearly about what's going on, and to put forward their best selves to lead toward constructive processes and constructive outcomes. So what I would say is that in conflict situations, it's really good, if we can, have that awareness to slow down the tempo, take a step back, and create that space. Now, I sometimes, for myself, I visualize an actual physical space, a physical space in my chest area where my emotions are, my heart is, and I visualize a physical space between myself and the other person. And by doing that, that helps me take a step back, open my arms up, and really create that space instead of being very tight physically, holding my arms and chest together, because then that keeps me very tight physically. I want to be open, which means I have to trust and be vulnerable and allow myself to be vulnerable and trust what's happening with the other.
Yes, that really resonates. I can feel the space between, and what that says to me is that the priority is the relationship. That it's not me against the other, me against the world, that I am in constant relationship with people. And that sometimes I want to be, you know, quote unquote, wrong, because I want there to be an opportunity for someone else to speak their truth, for us to come to a creative outcome or goal or creation together. And of course, it's not about right or wrong, but sometimes that's what the mind says. There's a sense of chatter that goes on, and it's not about rising above the chatter or ignoring it, but it's to become aware of it, and that's part of the dynamic in our human day-to-day.
So I think that in some situations, they're very heated, and they're dangerous. And they're dangerous because people feel threatened, people feel unsafe. We know that if we just turn on the news any given day, we hear lots of situations such as that where there really is what I would say is a lack of understanding, a lack of tolerance, and that space for understanding others, and there isn't that desire. So when I think about security and safety, I think about it on a couple of different levels. One is that we have a desire and a need for physical safety. I need to know that when I open my door to leave my home, that I will be safe physically. There's emotional safety. I need to know that if I allow myself to be vulnerable to the other, that they will have compassion and take care of me and not want to hurt me. And I need to know that mentally, psychologically, that I also have security and safety, that I'm taking risks because I feel safe to do so. And unfortunately, sometimes we get to such a level of heatedness, for lack of a better term, that safety is really very far, and we don't even see how it's possible to get to that space of security. So I think that in some of those kinds of situations, and also this is a cultural orientation too, depending on the culture, it's not safe to be face-to-face with somebody else in trying to resolve that intercultural conflict. We do need to have physical space, and we need to have somebody or some group of people who are there as third-party facilitators of that kind of dialogue. And dialogue is what we really need to have, where it's not necessarily that we're coming to a decision about what to do, because we're not ready to do that. We need to really open up that space for understanding. And having a third-party facilitation process allows the sharing of information to deepen understanding, and the sharing of information through that third-party facilitator so it's palatable and understandable to other. Because typically, if we are heated and we are expressing ourselves, it's usually not only in a constructive way about what I need, but it's also condemning the other. And the other side is not going to want to hear any condemnation of themselves, because they feel potentially neutral towards the other side as well.
Yes. So what's resonating is this idea and practice of holding space. And I really love that phrase, how to hold space. How to hold space for ourselves, how to hold space for the other, and how to hold space for the relationship and what's happening. And I really want to highlight this sense of agency and self-awareness piece, because it's practice, and it's not about being perfect, and it's just about practicing what's going on. When I reflect back to that moment when I was 11 in Sunday school during my introduction, now as an adult, I can reflect back and see the complexity of that, you know, a few seconds, and be able to unpack that in a meaningful way. So now I'm building this muscle of self-reflection and introspection. And sometimes we're going to walk away from situations quite confused of what just happened. And being able to ask ourselves, what just happened, what's happening, we're practicing looking from different lenses. And perhaps when we can put on the table what our cultural lenses, what our perspectives are, what is socially acceptable, and what have I defaulted to, we can start to internalize it and shift it in a meaningful way. And sometimes when we have sudden change, there can be pushback. So to also hold space for that pushback, to hold space for the conflict. And essentially what we're talking about here is to learn how to just be in that space where it's uncomfortable. And that takes practice, because it's uncomfortable. It's not going to feel safe necessarily, but it's how do we hold ourselves when we're experiencing discomfort.
And good. So I'm thinking about right now in the U.S., there are a lot of issues taking place with racial divide, as some people would call it. And if we look globally around the world, there are issues of terrorism and what's happening. And there are some really difficult conversations that need to take place. And right now, there's a lot of reaction and reactiveness to it, and people want to quickly blame, and they're doing the blaming, I think, out of the sense of trying to figure out what's going on and to figure out how to be safe. The blaming, of course, as we mentioned earlier, is not a constructive process, because instead of blaming, maybe we need to take a step back and try to understand. And so there needs to be a lot more listening taking place. There needs to be the space to have safety and trust as much as possible to have these difficult conversations. Now, we're not going to feel good in the process of having them because they're going to feel physically, mentally, emotionally drained from doing that and maybe unsafe. So in those situations, I would say it's really good for two things to happen. So for one is to definitely have skilled, trained professionals who are facilitators to really be able to hold that space and provide as much safety as they can in the space. But then again, the people who are participating also need to take responsibility to want to be there and to hold that shared space. The second thing is, in the ideal world, which we can create, it's not out of our reach, wouldn't it be wonderful if we all had some kind of foundational learning and development around these kinds of skills? What does it mean to really get to know ourselves? What does it mean to understand our values and what's important to us? And what does it mean to really be generous to understanding others and not jumping to blame, but taking a step back and holding the space and holding the idea that maybe they have something really good to offer and maybe there's something really good and valuable in who that person is and me getting to know that person. And actually, maybe once I get to know that person, maybe I resonate with that person, and maybe we have a lot more in common than I thought we did. Because even though I may look different from you, I may still believe in a lot of the same basic principles and how I want to live my life and how I want my family to live their lives as well in a very safe, loving environment.
Yes. So it's about co-creating the container and co-creating the relationship, and that there is the light and shadow, which are opposite sides of the same coin, that as constructive as we are, as brilliant as we can be as people, we can equally be as destructive and dangerous to ourselves and to our community. So here we are in this world. I know that there are some trees that grow as tall as their roots go deep. And so how do we, as people, come together and be able to pay enough attention and to give enough of ourselves to hold these paradoxes and essentially to manage them? And right. Listening is a really great start. It's also very difficult, and it's worth it. There is something so valuable in just listening. And what we said earlier, which, you know, I thought of, is that I really believe in having a counsel. And I also believe in therapists, that there are professionals out there who are paid to listen and to really hear. And they go through all this training to really hold safe space and a container for each individual person, so that when we are in an emotional crisis, when we're experiencing chaos and we need to move our own energies to be responsible and taking care of ourselves, to go to our council, to go to our individual safe space, to our intimate friends and family and colleagues, to paid professionals, whether it's a life coach or therapist, or a way to console ourselves.
When you're saying council, I'm thinking about if we look at different cultures around the world and different traditions from around the world, there is that kind of provision around the world, and they're just called different things in different places. In the U.S., we tend to have a proclivity towards therapy and therapists. In some places, they don't, because it's a symbol of, or a sign of, emotional weakness, so they wouldn't want to do that, and that's certainly not what we're encouraging. What we are encouraging, though, is finding out where to get that counsel and that guidance that will help you be in that safe space. And when I think about listening, I think about so many different levels and what are we listening for. And one of the areas of development that we've learned in the field of conflict resolution is the idea of listening for needs. And so we may say lots of different things, and I take a step back through my training and I say, what's really going on here? What are they really saying? What do they really need? At the end of the day, if there's one thing I could do to develop a good relationship with this person and show deep understanding, I need to understand what they need. I need to understand that and then figure out ways of meeting that need. Because some of us are very articulate in what we say, but typically we don't speak on the level of needs, because that means we're vulnerable, we're opening up, others, and especially in complex situations, all of us can be in the situation where we are not articulate and we are just blathering and blaming and really just saying things that are not going to really get us where we want to go. So many times I can be myself or see other people in situations, and in our heads we're saying, like, don't go there. Like, no, don't go there. But actually we go right there because of our habits. We just go right into that trap, even though we know on one level it's not going to get us where we want to be. The other thing that we were talking about earlier, the whole idea about constructive and destructive, and you gave a nice analogy of the trees having roots as deep as they are tall, is beautiful and kind of frightening at the same time, because if we can be so good and so constructive, that means we have the potential of being so destructive and doing things that I think we would regret deeply. So really learning how to manage so that we don't go there. Like, we might go surface there, but not deeply there, because we may get to a point of almost no return that we'll do things that we'll regret our whole lives. Like, why did we do that and why did we say that? When in actuality, it wasn't really our intention to do that, or we didn't really want to cause the kind of harm. We may have thought we did in the moment because we were so emotional, but in actuality, if we really go down to the deep sense of who we are, it's not what we really wanted to create in the world.
Yes. So it's about a level of perhaps maturity to be able to come to a place where when we have these strong urges of an emotional reaction, it is about being able to create that space to be able to move it ourselves, to be responsible for it, and that sometimes it's a systemic issue. It can be a cultural issue where when we are projecting what's happening for ourselves, and this often happens when we're blaming. The reason why we blame other people is because it's too uncomfortable to hold it within ourselves, to say, oh, maybe I'm a part of this problem. And that it's easier to push the problem onto someone else so that we can feel good, because we're in a state of anxiety and we're in a state of discomfort. And part of this is to learn that being uncomfortable and having discomfort and having conflict is normal. And to perhaps we can even step beyond this reactionary space and to expect it. It's not if this happens, it's when this happens. How can I best manage it? How can I be my best self? And to come prepared.
Yeah, I was also thinking about the paradox you mentioned before, like, so, of blaming others, but at the same time also wanting others to hold and embrace us back in a secure way. So we sometimes push away what we really want in those situations, including ourselves, that we deny ourselves or ridicule ourselves, when in actuality we also want ourselves to be able to show up and show up well in that situation.
Yes. So there's a lot that we've talked about here, and I think it'd be really good to open up the line soon and hear some questions that perhaps our listeners have.
Great idea. So I want to thank everybody for listening today, and we hope to hear from you, and if not at the end of this radio call, then maybe some other time. Thank you very much.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back, our listeners, our esteemed guests for today's important lecture. Once again, I welcome you, our listeners, from the United States and around the world, to the 2016 Summer Lecture Series of the ICERM Radio Program. I am your host, Basil Ogorji. We just listened to an important lecture on intercultural communication and competence delivered by our guest lecturers, Dr. Beth Fisher Yoshida, President and CEO of Fisher Yoshida International LLC, and director of the Master of Science in Negotiation and Conflict Resolution at Columbia University in New York, and Uriah Yoshida, director of communications at Fisher Yoshida International. Uriah and Beth, thank you very much for your inspiring and illuminating discussion on intercultural conflicts and the various ways to manage and resolve them. Thank you so much, Beth.
Oh, thank you, Basil. Happy to be here.
Great. And to you, our listeners, I am sure you have many questions for our guests. Now is the time to send us your questions. Please call 323-642-1236 to ask your questions and add your voice to the conversation. If you are calling from outside the United States, make sure you dial 1 before 323-642-1236. You can send us your questions to the iSound Radio chat box or chat room, and your questions will be transmitted to our guest for today's important lecture. While we wait for the questions from our listeners, especially those questions our listeners have for you, Beth, permit me to share my thoughts on how the important points you raised in this lecture resonate with me. I mean, this is a very crucial, very important topic, intercultural communication and competence, looking at the dynamics, the nature of intercultural conflict. Now, I must thank you so much for your methodology, your narrative approach, and the use of personal story about your work and your experiences in Japan and New York City, and the way you applied these experiences to three different levels where intercultural conflicts often occur, namely the individual, the interpersonal level, organizational level, and at the community or intergroup level. Now, in these three levels of intercultural conflict manifestation, if I may call it, or intercultural conflict manifestation, your lecture highlights the complexities and difficulties that are often experienced in an attempt to manage or resolve intercultural conflicts. To overcome these difficulties, you propose a different, a very unique type of communication and competence, which we call intercultural communication or intercultural competence. I am very intrigued by the example Ria gave about her introductory statement in a Sunday school, where she said, "Hi, my name is Ria, and I'm not very smart." Now, a humble and modest way of speaking, especially in Japan, which would have earned her praise and admiration in Japan, as opposed to the feeling of pity it generated from her American classmates. This is a very, very important, example here that really illustrates what intercultural conflict is. Especially the nature of intercultural conflict as they manifest if they are not well managed. Now, all the example you gave, Beth, the example you gave about community work or the community cleaning in Japan, which could be difficult, honestly, to organize in New York City. These examples, for me personally, underscore the differences between collectivist cultures and individualistic cultures when it comes to intercultural conflict. From this perspective, many scholars, including you, many research materials that you referenced in this very presentation that you just delivered here on iSound Radio program, have examined intercultural conflict from different perspectives. And those perspectives are also present in your lecture. Perspectives to intercultural conflict, especially the ones that resonate with me, are family and personal history. That is how our specific history affects our collective behavior, or especially how our specific history affects our conflict behavior. This is very important. And this leads us to the idea of worldviews, how our worldviews influence or how they influence how we think and feel about conflict, and how these worldviews or family history or our upbringing, how they have shaped our meaning of conflict in terms of viewing conflict in a negative manner or viewing conflict in a positive manner. These are very important points that resonate with me in this very presentation that you and Rhea have just delivered here. Now, also the various roles, metaphors play in conflict situation. And I really, really appreciate how you referenced some of the metaphors or gestures that are often experienced in conflict situation, how you referenced, made mention of these in your presentation. And the most important point that honestly I wouldn't forget to mention here is the role of gender, or what we call the cultural filters in conflict situation. And my question is actually going to be on the role of gender, because I think gender is also part of culture. Cultural differences, gender differences could really be a very big factor when it comes to intercultural conflict, either in group, that is at the group level, intergroup level, or at the interpersonal level, or even within the organization, organizational levels. These are very important points. Now, our personal history honestly includes all interactions, as you said, with others, up to the present. And our present approach to situations of conflict could be traced to our family history and explained through the term attachment. I personally, I am attached to a whole lot of things that I bring with me from my family background. And prior to even if the indoctrination of culture or cultural elements is honestly or begins in a family, because the family is honestly the nuclear, the most important atomic, which often is somehow neglected in public discourse or issues about conflict. I think there is a very important point here, and I really want you to most probably expatiate and talk or explain to us how families, the correlation between our family history and culture and conflict, and how the values that we acquire from our families could help us manage those conflicts when they occur, either at the workplace, that is in the organization, or the interpersonal level, or the intergroup level. Now, I also want to talk about gender, which I really mentioned before. And I think gender is important. Right now, there is a big debate here in the U.S. With respect to gender equality in terms of in the workplaces, increasing work pay for women. Gender and cultural filters could be looked at from the lens model, which honestly illustrates that people's views of self, order, and relationship are always, to some degree, distorted. And this is caused by filters. And I so much liked what Hawker and Wilmot in their book in 2014, a book they published in 2014, which is entitled Interpersonal Conflict, how they really explained these very important filters, which could really cover our eyes and prevent us from seeing what actually is real at the other side. Now, our background and biases provide filters on our views of the other and often block us from seeing what the other is seeing, or distort our interpretation and understanding of what really is. So here we have the gender filters and the cultural filters. So my question is, gender is often seen as a very important factor which affects how one interprets conflict behaviors. Males and females tend to differ in seeing self and other as connected. There is a very important point here. So if you could really look at this as well and include gender as a part of, as a factor in intercultural conflict, dynamics. That's going to be helpful for our listeners to understand what they could do when they experience gender-based conflicts, either in the workplace or at the interpersonal level, or even at the intergroup level. Thank you so much, Beth, and I will yield here, and I'm going to be taking questions from our listeners, and once you're done, I'll be transmitting some of these questions to you.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. So, yes, gender is very important, and in some cultural orientations, there are much more clearly defined gender roles for men and women, or now we have multiple ways of looking at gender. It's beyond just being man or woman. And some cultures have much more fluid boundaries between the roles. And so sometimes in our family situations, we are intentionally taught this is what girls do and this is what boys do. Girls don't do this and boys don't do this. So, for example, in many cultures, we say boys don't cry. So males would have to hold in their tears and suppress those kinds of emotions, whereas girls are allowed to cry, for example. However, sometimes these messages are contradicted by the behaviors that we have. And so there can be an alignment of behavior with the spoken word, and sometimes there's not. If there is an alignment with the behavior to support the spoken word, so there's a mutually reinforcing loop here, then it's a much stronger message than if we say one thing but actually do another thing. So in my own personal situation, for example, I grew up in New York City and I grew up as a very independent woman. And I didn't think of myself as being the subject of any gender discrimination, for example. I thought, well, I'm Beth and that's it. I'm just Beth. And then once I began learning more about differences in gender and how it plays out in the workplace, in a school environment, and other scenarios, I started more intentionally paying attention to my role and to see what was going on, and was I being a little bit blind to the fact that I actually was being viewed as a woman and was actually maybe being recommended for things because of that, or some privileges taken away from me because of that. And once I became more aware of it, I realized that actually I was not being treated what I would perceive as fairly as to some of my male colleagues. So that started making me think a little bit about that. And then once you notice it, then you have to figure out, well, what am I going to do about it? You know, so people who know me know that I'm not one to sit and not say something. So I tend to err on the side of saying, and so I would actually say something about it. I also tend to use humor. That's my way of taking emotions and sting out of certain comments. So I would maybe be playful about something, but very much assertive about it and saying, you know, I don't want the fact that I'm a woman to influence whether I'm being given an opportunity or not to do something, because that's not what I should be judged by. I should be also looked at as a person who may or may not be competent in doing something separate from my gender. And so then in terms of conflict and how we handle conflict, we're also told certain rules about what women should do in terms of handling conflict and what men should do and women should not do and what men should not do as well. And there are different allowances. So I mentioned earlier, like men or boys are not supposed to cry. In some more flexible environments, boys can be encouraged to cry, and that's okay because that's just an emotional expression. And it doesn't mean that the man is any less strong. It's just that he may be more capable and comfortable in expressing those kinds of emotions that women have been condoned for doing and so on. So that's kind of a little bit what I have to say right now about gender and about how the family plays a role in creating our gender roles and then how that manifests in our communities, in our organizations, and in our interpersonal relationships.
Thank you so much, Beth, for this important, very important response to that question. We have many questions here in our chat box, and I'm going to be taking them one by one. We have a question from Lioness. Lioness is calling in from Jacksonville in Florida, and Lioness is looking at the education system. And the question says, how can people, especially those in the education context, increase their intercultural communication skills?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, it can happen from very, very young age, and it just gets a little bit more sophisticated in its messaging as people get older in the educational system. But first of all, the teacher and all of the adults, including the families, have to be comfortable with these kinds of conversations and looking at this. And when I've worked with educational systems, I always want to first work with the adults in the system, because the adults, I want to be allies and I want them to support what it is I'd like to be taught. And that means they have to start to become comfortable with it first. Otherwise, if any of you have worked with children, they're really good at saying, well, that's not what we were taught, or that's not the way it's supposed to be. And I don't want teachers to be embarrassed about that. We also want parents to be involved, or whatever, whoever the guardian is at home, so that those messages can be reinforced. And as I mentioned earlier, the words and our behaviors have to be in alignment. So from very early age, we can talk about difference and we can celebrate difference and we can talk about values. And then people can start to understand that difference equals not necessarily good or bad. It's just different. And then how we work with that difference makes, well, all the difference in the world about how things will play out in relationships.
Yeah, I'm going to be taking another question here, which is also on the education system. And this question is coming from Mark, and Mark is asking, how does culture influence how we learn?
Yeah, I have an example of that I found really humorous too. So part of the time I was in Japan, I worked in the international school system, and there were children from all around. And somebody taught me this, and they were saying, like, if a little child, like say kindergarten level, maybe 5 years old, asks a teacher, how do I draw the sun? Then somebody was saying that because there's a different orientation to how it's done, is that the Japanese kindergarten teacher would take the red crayon and draw a beautiful red circle and color the red circle in for the child and say, this is how we draw the sun. And an American teacher would not necessarily do that, would just say, well, what does the sun look like to you? And so it's not to say one is good or bad. It just shows from a very early age, cultural orientation to the way things should be, the role of personal expression, the role of the teacher and the student, what is the teacher supposed to do? So my own situation, I was originally educated here, of course, and then when I taught overseas, and even when I do work in organizations and communities, I have to be mindful about what do people expect from me as the educator. If people come from an educational system where the educator is the person who knows all and is the expert, then if I'm to say, well, what do other people think? And let's get other people's opinions. While I may be trying to be participatory and giving other people a chance to express themselves, because that's my preference, I have to be mindful that some people in the room may think, well, she doesn't really know very much, does she? Because if she's not answering the question as an authority and an expert, then why am I here? And I don't respect her for what she's doing. So I have to be mindful about how I share information from my own perspective and how I elicit the sharing of information from other perspectives because of the difference in orientation to how information and learning gets done.
Thank you so much, Beth. We have a very important question here from Ronnie, and Ronnie is here in New York. And Ronnie is asking you, what are the obstacles for coherent cross-cultural communication?
The obstacles for teaching it? I didn't hear the whole question.
Yes, the obstacles for coherent cross-cultural communication.
Got it. So I always believe that the first step of almost anything is really self-awareness. And the more we know ourselves, the more we're able to understand our relationship with others, we're able to understand others, and able to understand our impact on others. Which means, in terms of intercultural competence, that we need to understand who we are. And if you have always been in the same environment and have not interfaced with a lot of difference in your life, I would encourage people to step outside of your norm, step outside of your comfort zone, and be in situations that are outside your norm, because then you get to understand who you are and what's important to you. It's the example people give as a fish out of water. The fish doesn't know it's in water until it's not in the water, and then it realizes what it was like to be in the water. So for me to, for example, travel and to live in different places, then I get to understand what's important to me, and I understood the role, for example, of individualism, or the role of being part of a collective, or the role of being part of a team, and what does it mean to share my opinion or not. So I think that coherent intercultural competence has to start with understanding self, and then also an openness and a willingness to understand other and appreciate other, especially in the face of difference.
Very important. And I just want to ask you a question based on your response, and again, the other questions that you responded to. And we have religious differences. There's so many religions. And here in the U.S., there is a very big debate right now around terrorism, violent extremism, which honestly is being somehow associated with a particular religion. And President Obama has refused to call name a religion as being, the source of motivation for violent extremism, which is very important, and I find it very, very interesting. How he honestly upholds the value of not blaming a particular religion, but again, blaming, identifying individual elements in those religions, most probably who are not even faithful to the values of the religion. So what are your views? Recently, we had Trump hacking the wife of Khan for not speaking at the convention of the Democratic Party. And again, most probably within their culture, there could be gender issues or gender, differences somehow, cultural differences, worldviews, most probably, that prevented her from speaking. And so I just want to, know your thoughts on some of these issues with respect to religion and conflict.
Yeah, it's a really, really complex situation. So I'll give a couple of points, and by no means am I really touching the depth of this question and the situation we're facing. I think that it's very easy, it's easier to just look at things as very black or white and just this is good, that's bad, and to condemn one group as compared to another group. It's just easy to do that. And it just feels, for some people, more comfortable to do that because the world is complicated and complex, and all of the issues around religious orientation and belief systems and so on are complex. And I think a lot of this comes out of an ignorance of not understanding or knowing. And so I don't mean ignorance in a derogatory sense. I just mean not knowing. And so what do we do with that not knowing? Do we just condemn and maybe have fear of the other or fear of the unknown? Or do we frame it with curiosity and say, you know what, I don't know about this other group and I really don't know what's valuable or important to them. Maybe I should find out. I did mention in the talk with Rhea that the world is getting smaller because there's more and more mobility, there's more communication, especially with internet access across difference. And so people of very different orientations are living in a very small shared space. And so it's not something that we can continue to not know about. We need to. We have a responsibility, I believe, to learn about others. And we're not going to know necessarily as much as each person knows about his or her own orientation. But I think we have a responsibility to know. I don't think there's any one religious group in the world at all that owns terrorism or owns being good or being bad. I think it's individual. There are people inside. And if I think about the pureness of religion or spiritual orientations, I don't think there's anything necessarily inherently bad in a religion or orientation. I think, unfortunately, some people interpret religious doctrine a certain way, which privileges them over others and causes for violence towards others. And this also has to do with gender orientation. Inside of religious doctrine, there are different ways that gender has a role. And I think that if the mother of the soldier Khan was quiet, we can make assumptions about why we think she was quiet in that moment. But I think instead of making a statement about why we believe she was quiet, instead maybe ask a question of curiosity. You know, gee, I noticed that you were quiet during this time. I'm curious why that was, and I really would have liked to hear your voice and hear your concerns and thoughts about this topic. So that's a very different orientation to saying, oh, she's quiet because women are not allowed to speak, which really is, again, kind of showing some ignorance about the matter, because when she was asked that question, she said, no, that's not why I didn't speak. I was very emotional. It's very difficult for me to speak, even after all these years, about my son's death. So I think instead of blaming and speaking without really knowing, we should take a step back and examine our own reactions to it and really try to enter in with curiosity. I mentioned mystery before. Enter in with that sense of curiosity about the mystery of not knowing, to learn more.
Very important, and I just want to thank you so much, Beth. We wouldn't want to take so much of your time. We have many other questions here, but I'm going to be taking the last question. I'm going to be taking this last question here from John, and John is asking a very important question. He says, I've been dealing with intercultural communication lately, so I have some questions, and I would want to ask you, can the differences between two cultures or two religions draw members of those cultures or religions closer to one another?
Yeah, I think, but it's a mindset, and it depends on how it's done. And so, again, if we enter with curiosity and wanting to know more, then we can learn more about the other. It doesn't mean we give up who we are. It means that we're open to learning and open to the possibility, perhaps, of changing. But there's not a commitment to doing that. And so I think part of the reason people sometimes close off the opportunity to learn about others is they feel that maybe it's a threat to their own identity. And it's, you know, a way I think of more is better. And so the more I know, then the better person I can be and the more empathic I can be with others and the more I can share with others. So I don't personally consider it a threat or fearful. I consider it more of the curiosity. So I think that religions and cultures absolutely can learn more about each other. That can also enhance, I think, their own orientation.
Thank you so much, Beth Fisher Yoshida. You are the president and CEO of Fisher Yoshida International, and you are also a director of the Master of Science in Negotiation and Conflict Resolution at Columbia University. And Ria Yoshida is the director of communications at Fisher Yoshida International. Beth, I want to ask you if our listeners, those who want to get in touch with your organization, the Fisher Yoshida International, how could they get in touch with you? Could you leave them a web address or something so they can get in touch with you?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So the web address is www.fyicommunicate.com, and the FYI stands for Fisher Yoshida International. So fyicommunicate.com. And there is an email address there, which is info@fyicommunicate.com. I'm happy to hear from people, hear their comments and questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Beth. We really want to thank you so much again for coming on the iSun Radio program for this important presentation. And definitely we're going to be inviting you again on a different day or a different time, and also for a different topic. For those who are just joining us, those who've been with us here, we've been discussing with Beth Fisher Yoshida, the president and CEO of Fisher Yoshida International and the director and faculty of the Master of Science in Negotiation and Conflict Resolution And we have Ria Yoshida, who is the Director of Communications at Fisher Yoshida International. And we just listened to an important, very important conversation on intercultural communication and competence. The podcast of this very lecture is archived on our website, www.isamediation.org. You can always go to our website to listen to the podcast. We want to invite you again for another episode of the ISAM Radio Lecture Series for next Saturday. Next Saturday, we're going to be having a very important lecture, which is going to be very interesting for those who join us on the air. So go to our website, on the ISAM Radio Program website, for more information. Thank you so much, and we look forward to having you again next time.
Thank you so much, Brunberg.
This program is brought to you by ISERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.iserm-mediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Thanks for listening to ISERM Radio, a global peace network dedicated to promoting inter-ethnic and inter-religious cooperation.
For complete information about the shows, including previous podcasts, visit the ISERM Radio website, www.isermmediation.org.
Stay connected. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. And let your friends and colleagues know about us. Join us next time for another edition of ISERM Radio.
Peace to our world.